Welcome to Fusion, a show for Relay FM members where I talk to hosts from various shows about a single topic. My name is Stephen Hackett, and this month I'm joined by David Sparks from Mac Power Users and Free Agents, as well as Quinn Rose from Mixed Feelings to talk about our earliest interactions with technology. David, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you bet. And Quinn, how are you this lovely Friday?
I'm great. Excited to continue my streak of making people feel old on every podcast I'm on.
Well, or how we could think about it, and don't tell David I said this, it could be that David's here to make us feel younger. I mean, I think it works both ways.
That may indeed be the case.
I chose the two of you very specifically because I know you have both had a history of technology. It informs the work that you both do. And honestly, and a little selfishly, we are all different ages. So if I'd done this with like someone who's, you know, in their early 30s with me, we kind of grew up in the same era. But the three of us, I think, really kind of span three really interesting times in tech, not only in school, but in homes. And I think that'll be sort of interesting to talk through. So as we're recording this in March of 2018, Apple's education event in Chicago is just around the corner. It's just next week. And I've been thinking a lot about the times I interacted with computers in like elementary and middle school. You know, we had my parents owned a business together, and we had like a Windows 3.1 computer my dad did spreadsheets on. But I didn't get to use it very much because it was like his work computer. But in elementary school, I came across like a LC520 or a Performa 520. It's like this all-in-one Mac. It's an absolutely terrible computer, but my elementary school had a couple in each classroom. And we basically just played games on it. But I wrote this thing back in 2011. It'll be in the show notes. About my sophomore year of high school, I got sort of hired on to the high school newspaper staff. This is in like 2001. And that decision by that teacher to let me be on the newspaper staff for some reason, I had no experience, really like totally changed the course of my life. Like I fell in love with the Mac, fell in love with like design, using computers to like take it a thought and like put it into the world. All that stuff I still care about came from that, like that instance of like sitting down in front of a Mac for the first time, like opening Photoshop and opening Cork Express, which of course now no one remembers. So I'm curious about the two of you, if you have an experience like that. For me, it's a very like singular moment that really changed a lot of my life. But I'm kind of curious about the two of you. So David, what about you? Where did you first sort of come in contact with technology as a kid?
First of all, I really like the way you introduced me in the way that you said we needed someone very nicely that's old as dirt on the show, because that's me on the Relay Network.
Putting words but in the mouth.
Yeah. So computers for me were like magical when I was a kid. I was born in 1968. So I was young when things were first starting to get rolling. And I grew up in a family with a bunch of kids and relatively no money. You know, we didn't have a lot of money growing up. So they were this mysterious thing to me that were a lot of money. Back then, they were still thousands of dollars, except back then, thousands of dollars represented a lot more than it does now. So I wanted one desperately. The first computer I worked on, it was probably an Apple II. I think it was in school. And I immediately took to it. We had like a science class. We had like one in the school. And the teacher who was recognized me as a nerdy kid. And I would go into my lunch breaks and stuff and learn to program it. And just the idea that I could write some code and change what appeared on the screen to me, you know, it was crazy. And I guess this is to put it in perspective, I mean, this is the age of like Lawrence Welk and, you know, just like, I don't know, just the idea that you could change what showed up on that screen was amazing. So I immediately took to it and I loved computers from the very beginning, but I didn't have one. So I had a very interesting kind of way that I would program computers. I don't know if you want me to go into all that or not.
Let's just go deep down the rabbit hole here.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, you only got lunch breaks at school, you know, on days, of course, that I wasn't in chess club because I'm a nerd, you know. But the so I had, you know, the time at school, which was very limited, but that wasn't enough for me. So I started, like, begging my parents for them. And there were all sorts of different computers kind of floating around at the time. Most of them didn't have displays on them. My dad worked in a lumberyard, and he would make extra money at night by running plans where, like, you know, back then you'd need to know, if I'm going to build a house, how much wood do I need? So he had rulers and things he would figure out. He'd get the plans and figure out how much wood they need. And then eventually he got a sort of computer. Didn't actually have a display. It had a bunch of buttons on it and a wheel, but I figured out how to program that. And then after that, they started showing up with screens on them. And the nearest way I could get to a computer was a Radio Shack, which was about a mile and a half from my house. And I had my sister's used Schwinn 10-speed bike. That's right. I rode an orange girl's 10-speed to the Radio Shack. And one of the nicest things that happened was the guys that worked there were super lazy. It's not that they really wanted to nurture me. It's just that they just didn't care. You know? And so this little kid would show up, and they would let me sit for hours at the Tandy computers. I think it was the TRS-81 that I first programmed on. You know, they had a basic program, and they had a cassette tape where you could save your stuff. So I would start writing programs on it, and then they would save them to the cassettes, and then they would show them to people when they wanted to sell the computer. They'd load my programs in. And there were a couple different Radio Shacks. I would, like, rotate around the Radio Shacks in the community, you know, because I would literally be there for, like, 4 hours at a time.
You know? That's awesome.
They were super nice. So a lot of people make fun of the trash 80s, but, you know, they still have a warm place in my heart.
Yeah.
But that was one of my scams I ran. Then they started making consumer-based computers. I remember there's one called the Timex Sinclair that wasn't even a real computer. The keyboard was like this mesh piece of plastic. I begged my parents for that because it was like in the $200 or $300 range, but they never bought it for me. And I just worked my way around, guys, until I was about high school. Then I got a used Atari 800 from somebody, and a friend of mine. It was right with the Mac. The original Mac came out, and a friend of mine had money, and they got that one. So he had the Atari 800, didn't want anymore. So I got that. And I programmed the hell out of that thing. I was doing I made games on it. And then when I got to college, we had a computer lab, and I just camped out there. I didn't have a Mac until much later, but I mm-hmm. worked on a Mac all through college.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. So many people grew up with computing in the 80s, and they grew up programming, because that's really, if you wanted to do anything on the computer, you had to do the programming yourself.
Yeah, and there were no apps.
Right. Yeah. And even by the time, you know, the 90s rolled around, that had already sort of faded away. And I think there's this whole generation of people who got into computers, got into programming. Maybe they end up doing it for their career, maybe not. But that's definitely something that has changed hugely now. Like I can, you know, consider myself like a pro Mac user, and you know, I could do a little bit of programming to like clutch something together in the terminal, but I am by no means writing applications, right? I'm doing like some scripting and stuff, and that's a whole giant shift that has taken place.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't program anymore. I couldn't program my way out of a box at this point, but the but I remember reading an article at some point where Wozniak had said, yeah, the idea was you'd make your own apps. We didn't really think we'd be making your programs for you.
Yeah, that's funny how that changed. So Quinn, what about you?
Yeah, meanwhile, in Gen Z, I find it interesting that both of you have a lot of very specific names for the computers that you were using, partially because you're nerds, but also like I feel like when I was growing up, technology was so normal and so integrated that like I don't know the names of anything that I was using. But I know that I didn't have a computer like in my home my entire life, just because my parents didn't have a lot of money when I was little. But it basically in my living memory, there was this giant like PC desktop computer that was sitting in our family room. And I never used it except occasionally to play video games. But then in school, I had an interesting technology experience in school because I went to elementary school in Maine, which has the Maine Learning Technology Initiative, MLTI. And so we had computers and other technology in the classroom, and like we tended to have a lot of new stuff and a lot of resources for students, which is weird because I went to pretty underfunded public schools. But because of this technology initiative, which allowed schools to get grant funding specifically for laptop for students and smart boards and stuff like that, we had a lot of that equipment. So from fifth through eighth grade, I had a personal laptop that was mine, supplied by the school, that I could bring home with me every day and for was all intents and purposes my laptop. Like, you weren't supposed to do non-school things on it, but they didn't really check, so there was really no enforcement of whether or not what I was doing on it. And then later on, like in high school, we didn't have that, but there was still the school still had a computer room with these big boxy PCs, but then they also had all of these MacBook Pros that were just like in stacks and were available for students to use as well. And so there was this real mix of the kinds of computers that we were using in class, as well as a lot of students had their own at that point. So I got my own computer that I had, like, and it was a MacBook, not a MacBook Pro, a MacBook, right before I went to high school, and then got a MacBook Pro right before I went to college. And so those are the computers that I've had throughout my life in my personal space.
I think when I was in fifth grade, I would have sold a kidney to have a computer I could take home every day.
It was so cool. We thought we were so cool.
Yeah, and that's really the model now more and more, like one-to-one programs where iPads or Macs or Chromebooks are rolled out, and students can, you know, use them in the classroom or take them home or use them for other things. And I can't help but think that that is more and more the future. But the big difference, too, I think, is that, you know, you mentioned having like the PC at home in the family room. You know, my parents had one as well. It was like in a piece of furniture designed for a PC, like had a place for the tower and like a place for the CRT. And it's like this computer hutch, right? It's like in my mom's garage now. She holds, I don't know, paint cans in it or something. But it's gone even from something that, you know, you got to use at Radio Shack when you went down there and bugged the employees, to something that was like in the living room. Like, I go to the computer, it is a like a thing, like a destination, right? I'm going to go and I'm going to go do some computer stuff, and then I'm going to leave the computer and turn it off and go do something else. And now, Quinn, like you said, it is just everywhere. You know, I look at my kids who are in elementary school, and their school doesn't have a one-to-one program, but they have a computer lab that's pretty heavily used and a library that's got some computers in it. But then I look at their home life, right? Like, they've got iPads they can use. They use my wife's MacBook for some homework that requires Flash, unfortunately. And I see them, and for them, there is no – the computer has no level of separation, right? Like, it's not – they've got to go somewhere. It's not that even I have to go to the certain room it's in. It's that – it's like sort of ambient. Like, it's just sort of – always available to them if they need it. And that, I think, is it was really the dream of those so like sort of early computer people, right? The idea that Microsoft had of a desk on, or a computer on every desk, and then eventually a computer in every home. Apple wanted to see a computer in every classroom. That was a huge part of Apple's DNA early on, of giving an Apple II to every school in California, that sort of thing. And you know, I don't know what the answer is to this, but I can't help but think that there are pros and cons to that, right? That there are things that we have lost because a computer is sort of everywhere now.
I can say my kids look at the computers as an appliance, you know, more than anything else. I mean, they use it to get work done and then they move on.
I think there's an interesting part of this as well, which is as computers have become ubiquitous, And in schools, there's this reliance on teachers assigning work that requires a computer. But then in low-income communities, or like if somebody doesn't actually have a computer at home, which still, even though it seems so ubiquitous, a lot of people don't, there's this gap as well where it's very easy to get done if you have access to the internet, if you have access to a computer, but it becomes so much more difficult for those people who don't.
Yeah, and that's where you see, you know, some schools trying to do like one-to-one programs to try to close that gap. But it's definitely a very a very real thing. You know, for a long time after college, I worked as a consultant for Apple in K through 12. And so we, like, they would hire us to go, and I think the worst job I ever did was I deployed like 2,000 iPod touches in the state of Florida. It was awful.
Wow.
But, you know, even then was the idea was that this is a cheap device and we can put technology in the hands of students who don't have access to it elsewhere. But, you know, for the most part, the schools that were our clients, that were Apple's clients, were very much the same, right? They were, you know, upper middle class, upper class schools that they were public, but they also had a lot of like parent funding and like booster support to help pay for this stuff. And I think that was the same then when I was doing that 10 years ago, but I think it's the same now where this stuff varies so much school to school or, you know, neighborhood to neighborhood or whatever, because of the expense and the access is still too great of a hurdle for some. And I hope that that's changing. I think it is. I think things like Chromebooks are showing that it can change, but mm-hmm. it's definitely a very real issue. So, you know, thinking about our own experiences, reflecting on sort of how we first met technology in education and sort of in our own personal lives, are there things that, like, did it feel important at the time? Like, I know we're, like, at least David and I were, like, nerdy and excited about it. But, like, did we have the awareness that, you know, this is a tool that I can really use to improve myself or improve my education? Or were we distracted by sort of, like, it's a fun thing to get to do?
For me, at least, it was just the magic of the device. I mean, it was a weird time because there weren't really many computer programs per se. And just learning how to kind of bend the machine to your will was the fun. And I don't know, it's really hard for someone that didn't grow up in that era to appreciate. I mean, there were no internet. I mean, there were no, if you wanted to get ideas from other users, you had to go find other users or go buy a magazine and then type in the code that the basic program that they'd have printed in the back of the magazine. So it was really a solitary thing in a lot of ways back then. And I was a kid. I wasn't thinking about what's the future going to be and what's all this going to mean, you know, but I knew that it was really, I really enjoyed trying to run a program, you know, come up with the logic and having it break and then, you know, the challenge of finding a way to make it work and then trying to make it work better. I remember I built my own game at one point when I was in high school on the Atari 800. It was a simulator for a tail gunner and a B-17 bomber, you know, and I did it with player missile graphics, some assembly code, and some basic. It was just this cobbled together horrible thing. But I figured out how to make the guns fire. I figured out how to make the, you know, the plane you were trying to shoot move around the screen. And with some, I had like my own version of logic to it. And then all my friends wanted to come over and play it, you know. And it was just cool. That was the kind of stuff we were doing at the time.
Conversely, for my experience, it was all about reaching other people online. I mean, I was in elementary school when I got a Facebook page. And so I think that experience of social media, of honestly just Facebook for a while, I think, and then slowly other things started to reach through our bubble, was a large part of what it meant to have access to a computer and to be able to talk to people that you know.
Yeah, and I think I'm right in the middle of that transition. Like, I remember, I mean, it's maybe hindsight, but I seem to remember that being impressed upon me very early on that if I figured this out, then I could take an idea I had and, like, make it real. And that was just in the context of, like, a student newspaper, but it's still what I struggle with today, right? Like, if I want to produce something in Logic or in Final Cut, like, I have this movie or podcast in my brain, I have to figure out the tools to get it out there. But you know, we didn't have internet access at home at all, like even up through high school. We were late on that. All my friends had AIM accounts and, you know, were doing stuff, and we just didn't. Then I moved to college and had a dorm with like high speed, like Ethernet just in the wall. Like all of a sudden had the whole, you know, world opened up to me and spent too much time in college online as a result of it. But, you know, I think that is fading over time, that, you know, it has just become like – technology and like communication and like connecting with other people, that's all like one thing now, right? Like I look at my business and it exists completely on the internet, right? Like it's all on Slack or iMessage. And that's how like my business partner and I make decisions about our company and like run the business. And I think about that, and even 25 years ago, that would have been like impossible. And when I think about the next 25 years of technology, you know, what will my kid's life be shaped, you know, by this stuff, how that will look. You know, I can't predict that future. I'm not nearly smart enough for that, but I could tell you that like, I'm excited for the opportunities they'll have. But, you know, at the same time, I sort of have trouble picturing where it can go from now, because it seems so great now. Like I, you know, we have all this great stuff and they're powerful and they can do all these things. And, you know, 25 years, we'll look back at, you know, the iMacs and MacBook Pros we're using right now and think they're toys.
Yeah.
One other kind of funny shift that this reminded me of that I think that I sort of experienced through my life is that I remember when I was little, this idea of like, do not tell anyone your real name on the internet. Do not talk to anyone you do not know on the internet. Do not put anything out there that people could possibly ever find out who or where you are. And part of that was because I was a kid, but I think that there was definitely that attitude. But with the rise of social media and the rise of like people making careers on the internet and running whole businesses, and now I just like share my whole life on podcasts, and that's a totally well, actually it still freaks my mom out, but for most people that's a totally acceptable thing to do.
Yeah, I mean the whole switch to the internet, that's a whole nother day for, I'll have to talk to you about that another time, because I don't want to waste everybody's time. But it really is remarkable when you think about like even just looking at, I gave Stephen the link for the Timex Sinclair, and I'd encourage someone who's younger to go look at how bad that computer was just a few years ago. And I can only imagine where we're going to be in the future. And for me, I embrace it all. I can't wait to see what's happening. I'm spending tons of time with the iPad, even though I grew up using the command line and then the graphic user interface. I'm always ready for what's next. I want to see how this stuff ends. You know, I want to enjoy the ride.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, we have all seen how more and more mainstream it has all become, and how, and really how much further it has to go, right? That it's mainstream for a lot of people, but for also for a huge number of people, it's not. And I think it's an exciting time to be involved in this stuff. So, well, I appreciate y'all coming to hang out and going down memory lane with me. It's always fun to talk about old stuff, right? Like reflect and you know, go buy a crazy old computer on eBay. That's what you should do, David. You should buy a Timex Sinclair 1000 on eBay.
At one point when my kids were young, I actually had a, which Mac was it? I think it was the Mac SE, because I always wanted one but could never afford one. So I got like a used one for a couple $100. And
yeah,
when I didn't want my kids, they were too young to be on the internet, but they wanted to start like typing papers and stuff. And I had this real crazy system where they could write their papers on the Mac SE, and then we had a floppy disk. It was
that's awesome.
It was nuts. It was nuts.
That's great. You can pick one up for like $30 on eBay. So I think you should.
Yeah.
I think you should do that. Don't listen to me. I'm an enabler of collecting old technology. So.
Yeah, but I don't like to keep a lot of stuff around, so I probably won't. But there's a part of me that would love to get one of those running again.
Yeah. Yeah. They're cool. So Quinn, where can people find you on the internet if you want them to? I mean, maybe you still have that lesson from your mom drilled into your head.
Yeah, no one follow me. No, you can listen to my show on Relay, relay.fm/mixedfeelings, or you can follow me on Twitter at aspiringrobotfm, and I have other stuff, but you can find it on Twitter.
You can find me over at macsparky.com, and then my two podcasts on Relay FM are The Mac Power Users and Free Agents.
Awesome. Well, thank you for joining me, and listener, thank you for supporting Relay FM. If you're listening to my voice right now and you're not a Relay FM member, it's okay. We forgive you, but you should totally sign up and support one of the shows that these awesome hosts are on. They do some really great work. You can learn more at relay.fm/membership. And until next month, adios.